This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from Master Wu Men's Gateless Gate, 35. Jean and her soul are separated. The main case. Master Wutsu Fayen said, Jean and her soul are separated. Which is the true one? Women's commentary. If you're enlightened in the truth of this koan, you'll then know that coming out of one husk and getting into another is like a traveler's putting up in hotels. In case you are not yet enlightened, do not rush about blindly. When suddenly earth, water, fire, and air are decomposed, you'll be like a crab falling into boiling water, struggling with seven arms and eight legs. Do not say then that I have not warned you. The poem. Ever the same, the moon among the clouds, different from each other, the mountain and the valley. How wonderful, how blessed. Is this one or two? So this morning we're concluding an introductory retreat, and so I'll say a little bit about the koan, which is a way of seeing into one's nature. It is a way of practicing Zazen. It is a way of taking up one's life. It is a practice of intimacy. It is a way of meeting all of the many obstacles that we experience as obstructing our path. In a sense, it is the universe itself. And there are many different koans, questions, passages of sutras, dialogues that the student takes up into their zazen, into their meditation. This is a more advanced koan in the sense that it takes, some practice and development to work with this koan well. Koans are dangerous because they're using language and ideas, which we so easily get tangled up in. So the challenge for the practitioner is how to take the koan in very deeply and not think about them, not go to the meaning of the words and yet not ignore the meaning, not try and project or interpret the story or an answer or a question, and yet not ignoring any aspect of it. And in that way, it's a perfect embodiment of what Zazen is, which is in every arising of phenomena, there is not denying, but there's not entangling. This koan is a favorite of many because it's a story, and who doesn't like a story? And it's a love story. So, and there aren't a lot of those going around in this particular camp. So, and it's a good example of how Fayen took up something that was, a well-known story of his time that his students would have all been familiar with, I presume. And in a way that would, in a story that would have been understood in a very ordinary way as a love story. And yet it's an excellent example of how, as a teacher, he saw it. He saw the Dharma. He saw samsara. He saw the path of liberation within this story, because that was the ground upon which he was standing. And so he invites us into this ordinary tale, right, which is a tale that has been told 100 billion times in different ways, to see it in a new way. And not only to see it, but to let it help us liberate ourselves. So the story itself is that in a long, long time ago, there was a young child named Jean, whose father was Chan Kien, and who loved her very much, and she loved him very much. They were very close. And Jean had a best friend, Wang Chao, young boy. And they grew up together, played together, were fast friends. And one day her father said, "You guys would make a beautiful couple, right, when you grow up." And so as they grew up, they did fall in love, were very much in love with each other. But her father had other plans, and so he had decided, as was the custom of that time, that she would marry somebody else in their village. When they both found out about that, they were so distraught that Wang Chao couldn't bear the thought of living in the village and seeing his beloved married to somebody else. And so he thought, "I just have to leave. I cannot bear this." And so late one night, he set out in a boat to head downriver, and he was going to make a new life for himself in some other place. And as he was going downstream, he sees a vague figure running along the shore, calling out to him. And as he paddles over, to his great delight, it's Shan. And she is distraught and it finds unbearable the thought that he will leave. And so they decide that they will go off together. And so they do. They, in a sense, elope. And they go to some other village in some distant land and marry and have children and set up a life for themselves. But she is torn because she loves her father very much and she has gone against his wishes, which is not a small thing. And so one day she lays open her soul to him and says how much she is distressed by this. And he, too, in his own way, has been feeling unresolved about this. And so he says, "Let's go back and beg your parents' forgiveness and try and, you know, restore this." So they pack up the kids, get into the boat, and head upstream. And so when they get there, they decide that Wang Chao will first go and meet the old man and make his proper prostrations and beg forgiveness. And so when he goes to the door, Wang Chao is, Chang Qian is delighted, overjoyed to see him. He said, "You just disappeared one night and you were gone." And Wang Chao said, "Well, I'm here. We've both come back to beg your forgiveness." And he says, "What are you talking about?" And Wang Chao says, "Well, Zhan and I, we left together and ran away and set up a life, but we miss you both and we want to come back." And he says, "What are you talking about? Zhan is in bed. The day you left, she took to her bed. And she hasn't left it since." And Wang Chao said, No, she's here in the boat. Come see." And so as they're walking down to the water to see, Chang Qian, the father, goes into Zhan, who's laying in bed, and tells her this story, that Wang Chao is at the door, and et cetera, et cetera. She gets up and starts walking out the door and down to the water. Meanwhile, Wang Chao and Zhang Qian have gone down to greet Zhan from the water, from the boat, who is now coming forward. And as the two Zhans meet, they merge and become one. And so that's the story, and probably much more elaborated. But so Fayan simply takes this and says, Zhan and her soul are separated. She was split in two, which is the true one. And so all weekend we've been talking about self-nature, the nature of the self, letting go of the self, realizing selflessness, bringing forth selfless compassion. The Buddha said that delusion is not just characterized, but experienced within ourselves as I am, I exist, there is someone at the center of each moment who is me, who is the center of this universe. This is me. There is all that I identify with and as. And this is mine. This is what I possess. This is what belongs to me. And the realization, enlightenment, is to realize I am not. This is not me. This is not mine. And so Wu Men speaks of it this way: when we understand the nature of reality, we will know that coming out of one husk and getting into another is like a traveler's putting up in hotels. So we can think of the husks, obviously, as all of these many identities. The one who stayed at home and gave up her beloved. The one who left and turned away from her family. And in this culture would have brought shame, right, to her family. So this is not a small thing. You know, we look at it in our culture, well, of course she's going with the guy, right? Because that's what we do, you know. Leave home, move 3,000 miles away, you know, and call up to say, you know, Happy Mother's Day once a year. You know, that's not everybody, but... And so in our time, we'd have to write a different kind of story, right? Because the whole point of it is that it has gravity. This is significant. This is not a small thing, this choice that she is presented with. And so the husk is the many identities, right? And so if we understand, if we realize, then we'll realize that as we step into one identity and then into another, and then into another, and then into another. These many aspects of what we call myself, it's like getting into it's like a traveler putting up in hotels. So, you know, when you're in a hotel, you move in to a room that has been set up to be a home, right? To make you feel like you're at home. It's got a place for you to put your clothes, and it's got a toilet, and it's a bed made for you, all ready to go. But it's not home. And you know it's not home. It doesn't even feel like home. But it's set up for that. That hotel room doesn't belong to you. You're just passing through. And so we could think of the self as a series of hotel rooms. One is the room of the child. One is the parent. One is the partner. One is the teacher. One is the worker. One is the business person. One is the construction worker. One is the retired person. One is seeking awakening. One is retreating into old habits. One is fearless. One is afraid. One is generous. One is stingy. One is a saint. One is a sinner. One who wakes up and meditates. One who wakes up and goes back to bed. Which is the true one? It's not an idle question. Who are you? Where do you make your life? When we are not enlightened, what we see when we move into that hotel room is home. This is home. This I am. This is who I am. This is what belongs to me. It's permanent. It's me. And as I move from one room to the next, we try and keep it organized and neat, right? Keep all those rooms aligned. Keep them in order. There are some rooms that are open to the public. Others, you can't get in. Others not only cannot, other people can't get in, you can't even get in. Which is the true one? And so here, Jean is the loving daughter, loved and cherished by her father, and much loving and cherishing her father. The loving woman, someone in love, wanting to raise a family, fulfill her heart's desire. One is faithful to the identity of daughter. And in leaving that is despairing in her heart. One is faithful to her lover and goes with him and is despairing in her heart. When Fayan says, which is the true one? He asks that rightly. He asks that very intentionally. He doesn't say, which is the good one? He says, which is the true one? And we can think that enlightenment, that realization, you know, we can think that the resolution to this story is you get to have everything. Right? And sometimes you get to have those things coming together, right? We work things out. But even then, it's not seen from the koan's perspective in terms of good, but what is true. And true according to what? According to whom? And so normally we try and reconcile our differences, which is very necessary and needed. And we need to get much, much better at that. But which is the true one is asking a different question. But which is not about getting everything you want, but about being at peace with everything that is. And so when we think of Jean or ourselves and all of our various manifestations, all of our various selves. So what is this? How do we understand this? On the path of selflessness, of letting go of the self. And so we can think of the self as something that needs to be let go of, which is both has truth to it, but is also dangerous. Because we can let go of something that is has validity and is cherished, and we're just releasing our grasp. Or we can see letting go as throwing away something that is like trash that we need to find distance from, that we need to throw away. That's not the letting go that we're practicing. And Fa Yan asks this question because he wants us to know. He wants us to very much not be like a crab in boiling water. And this collection of koans is known for being very direct. Don't say, I didn't warn you. And so the koan presents us with this double barrier. Are you this one or that one? Are you neither? Are you both? And he says, there is a true path, which is free of all, and then finds its freedom within a place and time. How do we practice the sense of self that arises? The Buddha said it is the, hands down, the most persistent sense in human experience, human consciousness. Even when we realize that the self is empty, even we have are well developed in the path of non-attachment, even as we have seen into and released ourselves from much of our karmic formations, that sense of self, of someone, continues to arise. And though we may perceive it or misperceive it as real, as being autonomous, independent, self-existent, solid, fixed, having its own power, how do we practice that sense of self without creating a conflict in the mind, not extinguishing, having no fear? And at the same time, realizing that all suffering arises with a sense of self. That's the only way it happens, so that we don't become complacent. And so within the Beyond Fear of Differences work that we've been doing to address all of this, the very overt and very subtle forms of racism and sexism and all the forms of oppression, of creating boundary, of creating selves within ourselves and others and groups, and attaching identities and meaning. There are 10 values that we've created, and one of those is the whole person framework, which we describe as, in our study and liberation of the self, we recognize that because our social identities, and I would say just our identities, which includes social, personal, all, because they're really undivided, are not experienced in isolation, and therefore we can't examine them in isolation. And I've paired with this the precept on proceeding clearly, do not cloud the mind, which generally points to clouding the mind with intoxicants, drugs, drink, any kind of obsessive behavior, fixation that clouds the mind's natural clarity. Here I'm thinking of it as do not ignore the sense of self. Do not ignore identity, but do not cling to it either. Do not solidify it, but do not misunderstand it as empty. And so when we speak of identity, it's the sense of a fact of being. Who, what I am. And so this koan is pointing to different identities: daughter, lover, woman, young, mother, lover. And the identity is the identification with that as me. And the identification comes with a multitude of stories, which are ongoing, right? We are storytellers. That's what we do. You know, what'd you do today, honey, when you come home from work? I tell the story of today. What are you going to do today? I tell the story of the day before me. Where were you born? Where'd you come from? I tell the story. How many stories have we told today during this weekend? How do you feel about such and such? I tell you the story about how I feel. How's your practice going? I tell you a story about how my practice is going. And within each of those narratives, there is an identity. I am someone who is this person in this story. And yet we are storytellers. We don't stop having these conversations. So how do we tell a story? So if we think that the path of selflessness is to extinguish all sense of self, we will go to war against the self, and in that, solidify it further, reify it further, and create much more misery under the banner of Dharma, but it's not Dharma. Nothing is to be extinguished, and nothing is to be preserved. In other words, can we actually live in harmony with the way things are? Which is the true path? Right? The question is, which is the path that you want? Which is the path that you expect? But which is the true one? Which means we have to deal decidedly with our wants, with our expectations. Can we see things as they are? A dream is just a dream. A story is just a story. A thought is just a thought. A tree is just a tree. Pain is just pain. When we practice in each moment in Zazen, that's the practice, is encounter that arising as just that. And then seeing it arise, see into it more. Realize it's like coming out of one husk and going into another. It's not solid, it's not fixed, it's not you, it doesn't belong to you. But it is arising in this moment, and in that it is my responsibility. And in a sense, it is this sense of something, and the question becomes, how do I use this? That's really the question in Buddhism. How do I use everything? Can I use it skillfully? In accord with what? And so we have to establish our aspiration, our sense of what kind of life do we want to be living and creating in this world. And this that is arising, is it arising from a ground of understanding, generosity, patience, compassion, love, or is it arising from a very different ground? As it arises, do I become deceived by it? Do I get fooled by it? Or does it actually illuminate? Does it have an intention within it? What is that intention? And so as we're telling this story, is it like a bedtime story where we're putting ourselves to sleep with it? Or is it a wake-up story, a story that brings us awake? So Jean was a mother, a woman, a daughter, a wife, and each of those identities was embedded within worlds of identities, within her time and place, her family, her neighborhood, her village, her friends and associates, her community, the histories, the culture, the country, obligations, beliefs, expectations, norms, stories within stories within stories. all with different purposes, in a sense, all with different intentions, some of them helpful, some of them not, some of them true, some of them false. So the sense of self that we speak of is brought into being within, through these vehicles that we think of as identities, as stories. And so in our time, it's culture, class, race, gender, sexuality, age, wealth, power. And within that, wherever we find ourselves in it or wherever we're put in it, because both occur, it comes with a narrative. And those narratives are sometimes intended to bring benefit and sometimes they're to create great harm. And all of that together is how I see myself, how I see you seeing me, how I see you seeing yourself, how you see yourself, how you see me. It's worlds within worlds. And every story is assigned meaning and weight and value. And so in our time, you know, to bring this understanding of Dharma to the stories of whiteness, of gender, of class, of all of the ways of the stories we've told that have created boundaries, groups, highs and lows, oppression, suffering, and to examine who tells the stories, who gets to tell them, who gets to assign the meaning, who does the story impact, and to see the stories that we don't even know are being told. Right? Those are the most important ones, really. In our study in liberation of the self, we recognize that because our social identities are not experienced in isolation, they can't be examined in isolation. Isolation itself is an illusion. And it's the illusion of isolation that, in a sense, can protect. I mean, the purpose of isolation is to divide. And so what is to study the way is to study the self. It means I cannot restrict my study of the self to my thoughts or to see my thoughts as my personal thoughts. How much of them have come from you? How much of my desires have actually come from you? You being you and every you. How much of what arises in my mind is true? We were meeting with the monastics in study earlier in the week, and I don't remember how we got on to it. We were talking about perception and consciousness. And I was saying that, talking about my own experience of, you know, remembering back in my childhood and with my family and all of the things, the memories that I have, they're so clear, particularly very significant. It's sort of those changing moments, those memories that were sort of, you know, identity creating. And how many times I've shared those with my family, my siblings, and they're like, what? When? Oh, that's not what happened. And all along I thought, how could you not have remembered that? How could you not remember it correctly? Right? I remember it correctly. How come you don't? And now I've gotten to the point where I don't actually know what happened. I really don't. And what I was saying was I've realized, in fact, it doesn't really matter what happened. That's not what I keep alive in my mind. What I keep alive in is, what do I remember as happening? Why do I remember that? Why was that moment so important to me? And why do I remember it now? And does that even, how does that even resemble what actually happened? That every time we tell a story, because we're storytellers, and you know, what do you want to tell it just a little bit better, right? To make it better, right? To entertain, to strengthen. So what does it mean to study the way? And so in anti-racism work, you know, part of it, particularly for white folks, is to realize, you know, to understand that racism is not just my personal experience. So if I see myself, I identify myself as a good person. I'm not racist. That means I, by virtue of that identity, I rule out anything that I might do or say that doesn't fit that category, right? Because I'm a good person. And so everything I do or say that isn't actually beneficial, that isn't helping somebody else, isn't included in my identity. So I either have to just not see it, which we can very easily do, or if I happen to see it, I can tuck that away, push that away, or rationalize it, or deny it, or go numb to it. And these are all of the devices that we talk about and study in trying to uncover the story of what we call whiteness, which is really just different forms of identity, which is studying the self. And like every dream, you know, when we're in the dream, we don't know that we're dreaming. And so to understand and liberate myself and to bring forth compassion, I have to liberate myself from the attachment to these identities, which means I have to see them, which means I have to learn how to meet them skillfully. And so all of that assembly of sensations and thoughts and memories and beliefs that I call myself, I must examine them and see how do they arise in dependence upon everything. The Buddha said all conditioned existence arises as a result of causes, karmic causes and conditions. That's the only way anything appears in the world. So to understand this being, to liberate this being that I call myself, I have to understand that web of interdependent dependence. And I have to examine how that which arises exists with not in isolation, right? Within webs and circles and embeddedness of family, social, society, cultural, historical. And so that whole sense of my actions, my thoughts, begins to take on a very different understanding. And how do we see how the mind and body and heart is cloudy with all that is unexamined? And see that in our cloudiness, we perceive that as clear. Then in our creating suffering, we see that as creating good. In our pleasure, in what we perceive as pleasure, we don't see how that is actually dangerous. This is what the Buddha taught. And so in that way, Jeanne was not just acting on her own. She was finding her way, creating her life within these many identities, these many social circles, narratives of her time and place. She was seeing herself through her parents, through her lover, through her community, and being seen in turn. We all come into being that way. So it puts a whole, it really helps us to understand liberating self and other. That we think to liberate myself, I liberate me, and then I have to go out and find all the others and liberate you. Right? It's kind of a perfect example of how in, you know, for so many years, in trying to address racism, white folks would say, you know, to people of color, well, how can I help you? Right? And that's why James Baldwin famously said, racism is not a black person, a Negro problem. It's a white person's problem. The way I help another is to free myself and undersee all of the identities, all of you here. And then to go, as I go towards you, I have to see you as you are. which I can't do if I'm embedded with all of my own narratives. And we can think of this on a national level. So our own narratives of liberty and justice and equality and fairness and peace, which are lofty ideals, noble virtues, things that we should aspire to. But what do we do when we encounter realities that aren't those? When we encounter, rather than liberty, confinement, rather than justice, injustice, rather than peace, war, rather than quality, inequality. What do we do with that conflict, that disparity? In the same way that when I identify myself as in a certain way, and then I see aspects of myself that don't fit that, right? If I'm attached to that identity, I've got a problem. Right? And so the way to deal with that problem is suppress it, deny it, avoid it, or to get entangled in it by just telling a new story. Explain it away. And so think of how we do that on all levels. You know, if you tell a lie often enough, it becomes a truth. And we can even see the lie being said, being told, go tell a lie. And that's on display. The lie is told. It's told again and again, and it becomes true. So even when we're seeing it happen, it doesn't necessarily free us. I was thinking about that in terms of recent news about, you know, administrative policy towards climate change. You know, that we're only going to, any reports are only going to include the next 20 or 30 years, because after that, when all hell breaks loose, right, that would mandate a very different response. So we'll just keep it closer, right, to sort of numb the sense of needing to do anything. We'll redirect the research. We will take certain language out. We'll just change the story. And in that, we get to maintain the identity. I'm okay. We're okay. Let's just proceed as usual. It's like delusion. If we don't do anything, delusion just chugs along. Right? In trying to eradicate racism, if you don't do anything, it just chugs along because all the systems are set up. In our delusion, all the systems are set up. All the stories are in place. They're all working. And so it takes a commitment. That's why Wu Man says, don't say I didn't warn you. It takes a commitment, an imperative to open our eyes and see and examine deeply. And to begin to leave those cherished rooms of beliefs and views and attachments. And so we sit down and we turn the light around. What is true? So when we sit and a thought, something arises and we judge it, we're trying to change it, right? We're trying to recreate, because what is true is unacceptable. And so to just meet it without the mind moving, or even as the mind moves, to see it move and to see the construction underway. You know, the Buddha lived in a world that he could see with his eyes, hear with his ears, touch. He could experience it on foot. When we went on a pilgrimage last year to India, we saw the range of his life, the range of his world. It was what he could reach by foot. It was very there. He met the suffering that he actually encountered. And if he heard about it, he might go to it. He could do that. He met face to face with his students every day within his Sangha, met leaders, tried to guide them. We live in a world in what we see, in which what we see and hear and experience is vast. We will never directly encounter most of what we hear and see. We will never know it directly. We live within sort of the drunkenness of what we know, what is presented in image and written form. We see the effects of past karma in the present. We see the creation of new karma. A spiritual path is deeply personal. The way we say, "Don't say that I didn't warn you," is, "Let me respectfully remind you, life and death are of supreme importance. Time swiftly moves and doesn't come back again. We should strive to awaken. Let us not squander this life." And so when Wu Men says, "Ever the same, the moon among the clouds, different from each other, the mountain and the valley, how wonderful, how blessed, is this one or two?" This is a very, very powerful koan. How do you resolve it? Which is the true one? The story resolves it, right, in the happy ending kind of way. But what if she had never gone back? So Jean lives out the rest of her life in bed, and Jean lives out the rest of her life distant from her family. Then, which is the true one? How do we resolve that? What does resolution mean? And so that's why to go beyond the meaning of words and phrases, we have to go directly into it. Be Jean yourself. Take up 2, 3, a dozen worlds in which you inhabit that seem to set you apart. Which is the true one? So I'll end with a poem. "Everyone is born the same. Each of us dies differently. When telling a story, see the dream that it is and make it the greatest tale ever told. To take out the ridgepole and let the walls come down. Sing it with your entire body and your entire mind. Having woken up from the dream, now dream yourself and everyone awake 1,000,000,000,000 times into the timeless, spaceless present. Now you have today." So I really encourage all of us, but particularly those of you who joined us for the weekend, you know, there's a lot of sincerity, you know, in conversations and face-to-face, a lot of genuine seeking. And I just really encourage, you know, but Dogen said that seeking mind is like a baby that you're holding in your arms. It's vibrant. You can hear it screaming, right? It's full of life. It's got it's full of life. It is life itself. But it's fragile, right? It's vulnerable. If you don't feed it, if you don't take care of it, it'll whimper, right? It'll try and get your attention, but then it'll go silent, right? And it's as though it's not there. But this baby doesn't die, right? It's always there because that's our basic nature. But what he's saying is tend to it. And within a busy life where there's so much to do, that where the consequences of not tending to it are tangible, measurable, to not tend to this deepest and most pervasive part of our life, which is, who are you? What is the true path? Is in a sense to not tend to the whole. And so whatever that path might be, the essential thing is to make sure it's true, it's worthy of your trust. And then sing that with your whole body and mind. When you do that not just for yourself, you're doing that for all of us.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about our ongoing programs and residency opportunities, visit zmm.org.